Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power, and we shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki Radio is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together to address problems rather than defend positions. Well, the current COVID-19 crisis is making these feel like what I would call apocalyptic times. And as you may know, the original meaning of apocalypse is the lifting of the veils. Indeed, the veils are being lifted on the fundamental weakness of our too-big-to-fail economic and political system that seems to be teetering, if not toppling, under the weight of the crisis. Add to this a president who blatantly lies and then demands that these lies be accepted as truth, and we truly have a situation. This up-is-down and down-is-up rhetoric and impropaganda is certainly reminiscent of George Orwell's 1984. As to why it's taken so long for 1984 to manifest in reality, the Swami has an answer. It's because the Republicans are 35 years behind the times. So do we say, all's well that ends Orwell, or do we see if we can overgrow Big Brother by fully activating bigger brotherhood? Our guest today, Duncan Campbell, has been tracking the path of Newspeak for years, and through his Living Dialogues and Connections radio show, he has conversed with literally hundreds of visionaries, luminaries, solutionaries of our time, from Senator Boren of Oklahoma and Governor Inslee of Washington, to teachers like Deepak Chopra and Gene Houston, to leading-edge doctors like Larry Dossey and Andrew Weil. Hey, there's a paradox. To economists, sociologists, scientists, and entertainers like Judy Collins and Richard Havens. In the process, he's gleaned a wealth of information, and as a synthesizer and a contextualizer, he has cultivated not just knowledge, but wisdom. He's a graduate of Yale University and Harvard Law School. He's been a participant in several world historical events, including the unusual distinction of being the only person to have participated in Woodstock, 1969, and in the Second Russian Revolution on the barricades, defending Yeltsin in front of the Russian White House Parliament building in Moscow on the night of August 20th and 21st, 1991. There's so much more I could say about Duncan, but this is only an hour-long radio show. So welcome, Duncan.
Hello, Steve. It's great to be on your program. I'm a longtime admirer and chuckler of your work across the airwaves in various venues all these years.
Well, thank you. You know, we really wanted to talk about a couple of months ago, you and I had a conversation before this crisis hit.
Yes.
About the Orwellian nature of our current society and administration. I'd like to start there, but I have a feeling that you're going to give us a lot more background and context during this first segment of the show. So I'm just going to cut loose and let you ride.
Okay, that's beautiful. I mean, your concentration on conversation is just like mine on dialogue. It's deep dialogue. We might go back to the slogan that I have used, or the trademark phrase, that dialogue is the language of evolutionary transformation. And these programs, Living Dialogues, came into being when I was shown back in 1992 in an unbidden way, you might say, arising in my consciousness, that humanity was at a crossroads. We're at an evolutionary tipping point, and there was an evolutionary imperative that needed to be met for human consciousness to go beyond its stuckness in what I call now its modern mind adolescent consciousness. And it would happen right around the turn of the millennium, and it had to happen in the new millennium or we would not go forward. One of the things that you've commonly heard is people say, if we do not have more women or a return of the divine feminine in the 21st century, there will not be a 21st century. And I have been speaking like that for 30 years on my program, and that was the original insight. And in a nutshell, what I was shown is this, is that all of us as human beings have in our heritage, our indigenosity, when hominids first appeared in the evolutionary context, that what the anthropologists talk about was an experience of all hominids, of all humans, at the very beginnings of our species, of what they call mystical participation, or if they want to be fancy, they say participation mystique. And what it means simply is that we experienced ourselves as if in a cosmic womb in the universe, a knowingness, experiential, not intellectual, experiential, that everything was alive with consciousness. The stars above, the land itself, plants, animals, and we humans all were an integral part of a fully alive universe, moving through various stages of consciousness, but nonetheless inherently alive and integrated and good, basically good and nurturing. And we might say in the Native American phrase, it's captured, this sense of indigenosity, when it is said, all our relations. It's an acknowledgement that everything in the universe is in interaction and interconnected and interdependent in a sacred way. Now, what that meant to me as I began to implement the imperative, if you might say it this way, that came to me was like Marshall McLuhan said at one point, that the medium is the message. I was shown that from that indigenosity of the great nurturing, we might call it the divine mother consciousness, emerged a breaking away, a kind of adolescent breaking away, if we want to analogize the human species to a person's evolution through life, a sense of childhood belonging. There's a belonging in the womb. If you have a good functional nurturing family, there's a belonging in the family as a child. And then you break away to individuate as a teenager, and you push away in this larger view, father, son, and mother sky. So we broke away and separated ourselves from nature. This happened, many people feel, and I think it's correct, when we move from hunter-gatherers and that integration necessary for survival with nature, and we moved into agriculture, where it gave birth, among other things, to domesticating animals, tilling the fields, and hoarding in silos, the development of the military or guards and warfare and violence to protect your stash. All of these things that came along with agriculture, then moving into urbanization and the impersonality of that, and then moving into the industrial age, and then the scientific age, and then the information age, and now the technology age. All of that, from hunter-gatherers forward, I call the modern mind. And prior to that, we see indigenosity, or let us say the deep feminine, birthing our species. But then we move from the deep feminine into this modern mind masculine, where we started to invent tools, things to make our lives easier for our survival and for our expression of being surviving in the world, but then move to a kind of dominion over, a kind of separation from the natural world. And the word in Greek for tools is techne. So we fell in love over time with our own techne at the expense of Mother Nature. We're paying that price now with the climate challenge that is ahead of us, but it's too far ahead for many people to pay attention to. So now is the time where we have to move our consciousness, I was shown back in 1992, into this transformation of calling back into expression. We don't have to invent this. It's already in our psychic and physical DNA. We just need to call back into expression that deep feminine, you might say, indigenosity. And a balance now with the indigenosity and the modern mind, you might say, as we go through, you know, the four-partite brain from the reptilian to the mammalian to, you know, our thinking left brain, and then into what was called our prefrontal lobes unity consciousness by, among other people, Joseph Pierce and HeartMath and great spiritual teachers and so on. That's where we need to get to. And if we don't do that, we're going to fall back into the evolutionary muck, as it were, as a failed species, as is seen in 99% of all manifest forms over the 16 or 13.8 billion years of the planet. That's a very real possibility. But if we do meet the challenge and we reawaken our indigenosity and bring it forward in a dynamic balance with our masculine expression into a kind of sacred marriage, we will not only be able to thrive, but also survive in actually a planet that will be rebalanced itself and will actually stave off and meet the evolutionary challenge of climate change, which in my view has been accelerated forward now by the coronavirus. The coronavirus is the same thing. It's an expression of deep imbalance and how we're meeting that challenge, deep imbalance between the masculine patriarchal mind of the last 6,000 years and its self-centeredness, its narcissism, its hierarchy, its control, its domination, its economic inequality, its estrangement even from the common good of our fellow human beings. We see all of that being acted out now in the world. So we're not meeting the evolutionary challenge. And particularly, we look around the world, and this will set us up for the second part of the program, and we see a worldwide transformation in our lifetime of accelerating authoritarianism or even totalitarianism. That's why I started taking an interest again in Orwell myself 2 or 3 years ago, because I could see all this coming. Harvard-trained lawyer. One of the things that I look upon is the body politic, almost like a philosopher doctor, if you will. And I could see that our system had very profound fault lines in it right from the very moment of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution by the founding fathers. There were no founding mothers, but only a white male elite, whether they were manufacturing elite in the North or whether they were plantation owners in the South and slaveholders like James Mason and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, our revered founding fathers, found a way in the Constitution, insisted upon by Madison, to create a U.S. Senate with extraordinary powers to balance what Madison warned about was going to be the tyranny of the majority, potentially with the House of Representatives. It ended up being the tyranny of a minority of wealthy white men, which we see now extraordinarily so, that could not even have been envisioned by the founding fathers, but was warned about by Abraham Lincoln. And when we come to the second part of the program, I'll read that and we can launch into this movement toward authoritarianism, which is being manifested in such a dangerous way right now by President Trump and how he's choosing to interact with the coronavirus warning, which I see as a deep initiatic challenge, not only for humanity, called forth by our own deep unconscious, but really by the consciousness of the planet itself. This is a way to get our attention in a way that we've not paid attention to Greta Thunberg. She's been mocked by the people at Davos who actually own politicians all over the world. Politicians really are simply puppets for what we're going to talk about later as the inner party, that rules Oceania and the totalitarian tyrannies of China and Russia, that are the tripartite global order envisioned by Orwell in his book 1984. And it's happening right here in America. Now, but going back to the big picture, we do have a choice. If we can call back in the values of the heart, the values of love, the values of compassion, the values of unity, we can move from Big Brother to brotherhood, as it were. That was a felicitous phrase that you came up with yourself, Steve, as we were talking earlier. And we'll go into that in the next session. But just to actually set the deeper context, I have to say that the key is dialogue. If we look at the cosmos itself, we see that, as I've proclaimed, even as being a non-scientist since 1992, that the universe is expanding exponentially, and it is manifesting more and more levels of diversity and complexity at higher and higher levels of unity. That's what we need to do as a species. We need to embrace diversity. We need to embrace multiplicity. We need to preserve democracy as the only way in which that can be preserved. We're in a petri dish of survival here. Democracy is the key, and America is really the only place where that last stand is going to be made or not made. China has multiple centuries of empire behind it. It's the identity of the nation. And the same with Russia, has multiple centuries of czarhood and hierarchy behind it. That's why Putin right now is consolidating power, even in the midst of this coronavirus, to be emperor, or you might say czar, until 2036. Xi has already gotten approval in his political structure to be emperor for life. And actually, the deep inner party of the Republican billionaires that really own the Republican Party, they want their puppet, Trump, to actually cancel this election and then become a repeat president, you know, as long as he lives. So the challenge we have now is to reestablish a communication between us which acknowledges that wisdom, as you put it, resides in each of us. You are wise. I am wise. You have this wonderful phrase, upwising, as opposed to uprising, but they're both expressions of the same thing. The wisdom is within us, and it gets evoked when we enter into dialogue with each other. You have X amount of knowledge, I have X amount of knowledge, wisdom, etc. But together, when we interact like this, we actually increase it. We learn something new. We bring something new of that diamond consciousness into existence, which is a collaborative effort. And I want to say, as we go on to the next part of the program, that it's key, our deep listening audience that's listening not only right now, but may listen to this even 5 years from now. They are virtually present here as a collaborator, like a three-level or three-legged stool. They are evoking with their deep listening and concern for these same kind of values that you have lived your life by, that I have lived my life by, that inspire your program and energy, that inspire my program and energy. They are with us. We are together, and they are evoking what's coming forth here spontaneously. So with that honoring of the three-legged stool, we can proceed now to focus in the immediacy of how we're going to meet this evolutionary challenge.
Perfect. Perfect way to end segment one, because we've got to take a break. We're going to be back again with Duncan Campbell and go deeper and higher. Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki, back after these messages.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me the voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay.
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, we're back on Wiki Politiki with our guest Duncan Campbell today. We're talking about how we get from Big Brother to bigger brotherhood. We got some background, a deep background, and so now we're going to dive into where we are right now and perhaps a little more about the Orwellian nature of our current society. You know, how we got here in these past, let's say, 25, nearly 30 years since you got your epiphany.
Well, I'll say this, that what I've seen, I'd like to go back just a little bit more in my own lifetime history here as an elder, meaning that we're all called upon, of my age group, boomers, to be elders as well as simply olders. And we have historical experience, you and I, in our life experience that is often not known by the generations that have followed us. So this is an opportunity to tell one or two stories that were part of my life experience about World War II and how the United States met a real wartime emergency as we are in the equivalent of right now with the invisible enemy, as they call it, of the pandemic, but no less real or dangerous than that of Hitler and Mussolini in our day. And the first thing I want to say is that real leadership was shown by FDR when he went to the automobile industry. And without even this Defense Production Act that was recently passed that Trump has said he's invoked, but he hasn't done anything with it because, as he even confessed, he doesn't want to make the companies upset that they're going to lose their profit or have to start making ventilators instead of automobiles and do that for the common good and lose out on some profit or bear the expense. So FDR went to the automobile industry. This is something I grew up knowing as a child. And he said, we need your help. We've got, now that we've entered the war after Pearl Harbor, to make 10,000 tanks and all sorts of armaments and weaponry and so on. And they said, oh, we're happy to help. We'll be giving you 20% of our industrial capacity here at the automobile plants. And FDR said, no, you don't understand. We're taking over all of your plants now for the war effort. It has to be done, and there will not be another rubber tire made for a car in the United States until this war is over. And he did that, number one. Okay, and number two, everybody met the challenge together. There was a large portion of the population. John Meacham actually recently estimated it as high as 40% that so hated FDR that they only refer to him as that man. And these were, you know, the loyal followers of the capitalist order who actually almost prevailed. And there's a new series, by the way, on HBO called The Plot Against America that just had its episode number two last night. It's every Monday night on HBO, and it's from the novel by Philip Roth in 2004 that imagines an alternative history where in 1936, Charles Lindbergh, the pro-fascist celebrity, pro-Hitler and pro-fascist, runs for president and wins. And that 40% of the population somehow gets him over the top, and he is a Make America Great Again guy. He's a racist. He's a patriarch. He's everything that Trump and the Trump followers are now embodying. But they got control in this alternative history. And it's a real lesson that it's just kind of coming in again, magically and synchronistically into our culture. I urge people to watch it because there is that aspect of the American culture which has devolved since World War II and is now in the ascendancy. I just listened to BBC moments ago before this program, and they said the latest Gallup poll shows that all of the lies and dissimulation and wrongheaded decisions of Trump are being embraced by 60% of the American population, not just the 48% that are ever Trumpers. 60% of people have now been conned into thinking that Trump is doing a great job with the coronavirus. So now's the time to make the analogy where World War II, it went one way. By one vote, actually, did we enter the war at a certain point in Congress, or we might all be in a very different situation right now than we are. So we're at a critical crossroads here, and it's our choice how it will go forward. So I just want to just outline two or three of the very basic ideas in 1984, the book by Orwell. And the first is that everything starts and manifests fully when the United States becomes an authoritarian country and abandons its democracy. That's the premise of 1984. There is a tripolar world with China, which is already totalitarian, Russia, which is already totalitarian. China rules Asia in 1984. Actually, Russia, the Soviet Union, rules from the Caucasus all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, not only Eastern Europe, as in the division with Stalin after World War II, but rules all the way through Western Europe, Germany, France, etc. And so they're the two other global powers, the one where the United States, which is in control in New York and with its subordinate ally, the Brits in London, which is called Airstrip One in the book, controls not only England, but North and South and Central America and Australia, the Commonwealth countries, and Africa, all the way from the Congo River south. Now, you have the so-called disputed territories, which are the northern part of Africa, Afghanistan, the Middle East, and India, which are constantly going back and forth between Russia, China, and Oceania. So Oceania is essentially, let's say now, the United States totalitarian empire, as I described. And so in that tripartite situation, there is constant warfare, because in the book, 1984, there are times when Syria, let's say, to give a very modern example, is under control of the, let's call it the U.S. or Oceania, and then China comes in and Russia come in, just as exactly as happened in this last year, where Trump, as what the Russians call their puppet, overtly on Russian TV, this was actually broadcast on American television, Russian TV describing Donald Trump as their puppet, with the puppet master being either Putin or Lavrov, the foreign minister, and they're laughing about it on state TV. Publicly in Russia. Never gets shown here except for that one time that I saw it, but it's clearly the case that Trump is acting on behalf of bringing about this tripartite, authoritarian, and then we might even say totalitarian, autocratic world order. We see already China's in place, Russia's in place, Hungary's in place, Brazil, the Philippines, all over the world, this right-wing fever, we might say, like a coronavirus, is happening. And in this fever, we now have right-wing movements spreading hate overtly, as a recent Richard Engel series on reportage on NBC in Germany and Austria and France, taking their cue from Donald Trump and his overt but then denied white nationalism. So this brings us to the concept of newspeak. Newspeak is a way of fake news emanating from the president or the authority, whether it's Putin or Xi or in our case Trump, who's constantly lying now. It's over 12,000, 14,000 lies that he's kept telling. Gore Vidal says that once a country becomes habituated to lying and normalizing it, it takes generations to recover. It's extraordinarily dangerous. Now, right here on March 17, there was an article in Apple which says Trump tries to erase the memory of his downplaying the coronavirus. That's exactly what Trump does and exactly what Newspeak does in 1984. The hero or the protagonist of 1984 is Winston Smith. He's living in London and he's working for the Ministry of Truth. The job of the Ministry of Truth in 1984 is to actually change the news every day and to obliterate what actually happened, which may have received a terrible misjudgment or reported a mistake on the part of the authorities, and puts it down the memory hole and keeps changing the story and updating it daily. That's his job, he and the other people in the Ministry of Truth. They're like the White House staff. They're like Grisham, who's the the mouthpiece there, whatever name is now, who is putting out these lies. But the main lies are coming from Trump himself, who has now taken over the daily briefings, which were supposed to be done by Mike Pence and the medical staff, including Dr. Fauci and Dr. Bricks and so on. One day, a week ago Friday, it's reported he was upstairs in the White House and he thought, oh, gee, they're having one of these briefings there. I think I'll just go downstairs and listen. So he came down in that ridiculous outfit that he wore to Puerto Rico with the white pants and the jacket where he was tossing rolls of paper to people and so on. And then he realized, wait a minute, I want to be in this briefing. He went back upstairs. He changed into his trademark taught by Roy Cohn to look serious. Dark suit, white shirt, tie, great big long one so it covers his big belly. And he came down and he walked right in and took over the press conference and discovered intuitively that this, in a time of social distancing, was the new Trump rally. And he could be there like Big Brother, speaking newspeak every day, one lie after another. It started out 2 weeks ago, barely, with him saying that the coronavirus was a Democratic hoax meant to attack him. Jared Kushner, of all people, 39 years old, and Miller, who is the 34-year-old in charge of putting people in cages in the border. Stephen Miller, the two of them wrote that disastrous speech of 10 or 11 days ago where he got on the television in the Oval Office and he did his normal white nationalist racist enunciation and the markets completely crashed, of course. And now he's holding Kushner and Miller privately responsible, very angry because they told him that this virus wasn't anything. It was a PR problem and he ought to deal with it that way. So now he switched his view several times. But since he's the only person putting this out, it acts like newspeak in 1984. He changes the reality every day. So incredibly, 60% of our citizens actually believe he's doing a good job. What a huge weight of baggage to have to carry forward to try to preserve democracy, which is the primary issue of our time through the coronavirus, because as Noam Chomsky warned, we cannot let COVID-19 drive us into authoritarianism. But that's exactly what it's doing. The Democrats have picked a very weak primary contender here in Joe Biden, who was on with Jake Tapper today and gave a very unimpressive talk, and he's not able to rally the troops. They have buyer's remorse already. Rumors are flying that maybe the Democrats are going to give him a way out and get Cuomo in there, who seems to be somebody who can communicate a kind of take charge attitude and do the right thing for the people, as opposed to try to advance his own electoral prospects, like Trump is clearly doing by saying this is all going to go away by Easter. We're going to come roaring back. As soon as he said this nonsense, this total nonsense. You look at Italy, you look at China, you look at Taiwan, you look at South Africa, you look at Europe. You know this is not going to happen. Even today, the UK, his buddy, Boris Johnson, mm-hmm. said exactly right. The opposite. Okay?
Yep,
and
exactly.
So what's going to happen? What's going to happen? He's making just what Adam Schiff says. During the impeachment crisis, he said, the one thing we know about this man is that he will never put the interest of the country before his own interest. That we know about him. That's why he needs to be impeached, because if truth doesn't matter, and if you don't recognize this, we're all going to actually be lost. And so the final, you know, thing to comment here for the moment is the fact that at this point, Trump seems to be prevailing. Rachel Maddow on MSNBC was an early voice last Friday night where she said, we can't be covering these press briefings every day because they're full of lies and they need to be dismantled piece by piece. And people are having tremendous problems as a result of the confusion. The confusion is exactly in 1984, keeping people's emotions full of fear and riled up with anger and blame and confusion about what's real. The word fake news is literally from the German, used by Hitler and Goering. Goering said at one point, if Hitler were to say 2 + 2 = 5, I would happily proclaim that and speak it to the masses. And that's what's happening in every one of these press conferences. And now you see Fauci is not there anymore. I predict he will not be there from next Monday on, because now the split has been made. He's trying to pump up the stock market, got it to go up 8 or 9% today with this happy talk about it's all going to be over by Easter, sacrificing our doctors, our nurses, our frontline people, not taking FDR type decisive action to require the automobile countries and companies to actually start producing ventilators, masks, etc. So we're right in the middle of 1984.
Don't you think that, let's say, when his reality check bounces, in other words, at some point, the war on reality has to be, at some point, reality has to win a battle. And reality has won several battles up until now. And this is his one rally. He has his flag up there. He's doing that. People want to believe what they want to believe, even the people who normally wouldn't like him. However, if it turns out that this virus is really a nothing burger, then he's right. But if it turns out that, as the medical authorities are saying, and people, even his pal Boris is saying, that this is something that has to be dealt with in a very definitive way, he's going to have that reality check bounce much worse than he has right now. It looks like we're coming to another break. We'll be back with Duncan, and then we're going to talk about what we do now. Can we overgrow this big brother and create bigger brotherhood? Steve Fairman here on Wiki Politiki Radio.
Hear, hear.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. because in 31 states it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org, brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Well, this is Steve Behrman. We're back with our final segment with our guest, Duncan Campbell, today talking about From Big Brother to Bigger Brotherhood. You know, there's a helpful metaphor. You and I have talked about this, Duncan, to describe the current conditions, and it's the one that Bruce Lipton and I used in Spontaneous Evolution, the caterpillar's metamorphosis into butterfly. And it's interesting that the caterpillar is nature's ultimate consumer, consuming, they say, 26,000 times its own weight in food over the course of its lifetime. So the idea is that we are now in the chrysalis, and as the caterpillar debris is falling all around us, the imaginal cells of these new, this new butterfly organism, they are beginning to emerge and perhaps beginning to connect. So does this ring true for you? And if so, where are we in this process?
That's a great metaphor, and one that I've been using actually myself since 1992 when I attended the Earth Summit on intuition. I had a knowingness like 2 years before it happened that I was meant to be there. I ended up going, you know, with a group at the last minute. I ended up doing all sorts of filming down there and conversations with Wangari Maathai, who was then completely unknown, the most articulate person I'd ever met. And many things of that kind happened down there. But one of them was I led a group in a march across Rio to where the indigenous people's conclave was taking place with very little media, and it was about a 3 or 4 mile walk. And on that walk was Elizabeth Sartoris, the biologist, with me. And when we got there, I did a video dialogue with her, she and I, using, among other things, exactly this metaphor of the over-consuming consumer society where the caterpillar eats, what, 163 times its weight or whatever, and eventually literally over-consumes and becomes a toxic dying sludge. And out of that dying sludge of the caterpillar, still encased within the cocoon, looking okay from the outside, but actually becoming dying sludge on the inside, biogenetically, that dying sludge calls forth its own antidote, almost like thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And its antidote are, as you say, these imaginal discs, which originally caught my imagination, because I know that in our culture, or since World War II and since the 50s and 60s, imagination has been sort of driven to the margins of our society by hyper-rationalism and control and hierarchy. And we had to call back in not only imagination, but the word disc really fascinated me because I was an early adapter as a lawyer representing technology companies going back to the 70s. And I was the first person to even invent the term computer law here in the Rocky Mountain area and list it as a specialty in the legal directory. So computer technology matched with imagination looks like it could be the vehicle if we can capture it with both those things in balance, like the divine feminine and the divine masculine coming together in mature balance. Now, the key here is that the more that the toxic sludge becomes toxic, as it is now with the authoritarianism and the extreme dysfunction and anti-natural world policies of Donald Trump, who himself embodies in a single person really all of the worst traits of America. And we need to own that. We need to own that shadow which comes out of our American dream. The American dream to work hard and get rich has a little worm at the heart of the apple. You don't want to get working hard to get rich. You want to work hard so you can be self-sustaining, owning a small business or a medium-range business, be self-sufficient, have your kids go to school, just like in the 50s we did after World War II. And that's when all of the economic quintiles were rising as one. Like Kennedy said, a rising tide lifts all boats. The heart of the matter that has happened is neoliberalism as an economic agenda adopted by the Democrats, not only Reagan when it started and Bush won, but very significantly, the Clinton administration passed six different laws, as Tom Frank points out in Listen Liberal, which essentially adapted the neoliberal Republican agenda in a way that they themselves could not have, except having as their cover a Democratic president. And then Bush v. Gore changed our whole history, where Scalia bullied Sandra Day O'Connor into that fifth vote, as she herself said before she died. It was the only thing that she ever regretted deciding as a Supreme Court justice. It changed history. If that had not happened, we'd have a 7-2 liberal court right now. Gore would have been president and so on. But it didn't happen. And what happened was the neoliberal wealthy elite just grew year over year exponentially under Democratic presidents, including Obama and George W. in the meantime. So we come back to that warning of Lincoln that I talked about in 1864. He said, now that we seem to be winning the war, and we're going to win the war here in the short run, I see a vision which troubles me greatly, that the power of corporations and their wealth has increased greatly during the war, and the wealthy will use their power, the power of money, which, by the way, I'll say at my own ad lib here, replaces the power of monarchy or the power of, you know, fiefdoms. Basically, it's the power of money. Money is power at this point. And that the wealth will, quote, play upon the prejudices of the people, you know, racism, xenophobia, misogynism, whatever, to stir up their emotions like Big Brother. Until all wealth is aggregated in the hands of a very few and the republic will be destroyed. End of quote from Lincoln. And that came about with the first Gilded Age, but then FDR was able to modulate that when he said in his opening address, we have always known that greed is bad morality, but now we also know that greed is bad economics. Now, behind the scenes, I found out from Mother Jones in an article about 30 years ago, that the wealthy had come to him and say, you're a man of privilege and wealth like we are, and we fear for our lives. You know, we're seeing what happened to the Lindbergh baby, you know, in the year before you got elected. Charles Lindbergh's baby was kidnapped and killed. And we worry about that same thing happening to us. We drive around the streets of New York. We see the eyes of hatred in the soup kitchen lines that extend for five blocks here in the Depression. And we're surrounded by private security. We fear for our lives, okay? So do whatever you need. Vilify us, say we're the problem, tax us, whatever. Do what needs to happen. And so we've gotten, you know, the various acts that were taken, the creation of the SEC and all of the Glass-Steagall Act and all of the Social Security and the other measures that were done by FDR to put restraints on capitalism and rule by the wealthy. That's all gone by the wayside now. Usually under the face of friendly, quote, Democratic Party leaders extending what originated there 40-some years ago with Ronald Reagan when he said government is the problem, not the solution. Government is the only thing we have to express ourselves as a people. We need to reclaim our heritage, just like we need to reawaken the deep feminine in our indigenosity. We need to take the best parts of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and override, you know, the ignoring of women, the ignoring of Native Americans, the slaves, and so on, all the fault lines that were there in the beginning, and the Commerce Clause. We need to somehow mobilize the imagination and the heart quality of people, because we have a destiny that either will be fulfilled or won't be fulfilled as an American people. And in this regard, I'll take a leap here and say that in the big, big picture of consciousness, one of the actors is a woman named Lorna Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E. You can go to her website, Lorna Byrne. I did dialogues with her in 2011 and 2013 when she came out with her first two books, Angels in My Hair and The Message of Hope from the Angels. Now, I replayed, rebroadcast on my program the last two Sundays. My 2013 dialogue with her is called A Message of Hope from the Angels. You can go to kgnu.org/living dialogues, and you can just scroll down and get those. Okay, that's kgnu.org/living dialogues. Her simple message is this. I find her very compelling and genuine and humble as a person. I've known her now for 10 years, and as extraordinary as it may seem, she actually has seen angels, as she tells stories very compellingly, published in 50 different countries, 26 different languages. She's been asked to speak all over the world. And what she says is that the transformation of spirituality, which is at the core of all transformation, where we reclaim the energy of the heart, the energy of love, the energy of compassion, which we're all born with. She describes a baby as being pure love and then withdrawing its love as it experiences the vicissitudes of, you know, acculturation and parental and bullying and all the rest of that stuff.
I must be on the wrong planet, you know, like I must be on the wrong planet. Yeah.
But the thing is that she says that she was shown all of her life that there were these things called American angels that even visited her sister as a 16-year-old to recruit people from all over the world into a multinational nation based on an idea of all men are created equal, even though we've never, you know, lived up to it. But it's still there as a kernel, a seed that can be nurtured, you know, entitled inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the deep feminine life, the deep, you know, a masculine liberty, and then forming happiness. It's there. But if it's not going to happen here, you look all around the world, and where else is it going to happen? It's not going to happen in China or Russia or Brazil or Hungary or Europe. It's only going to happen here if it's going to happen, which means we have to start now getting away from just defending against the lies that happen every day with President Trump, confusing the people and manipulating them just like Big Brother. The key insight of 1994 was that a totalitarian system itself won't work by itself. It has to have a personality that has a kind of dark charisma. In his book, that personality is called Big Brother, and he is adept in the same way Trump is of sowing disinformation, confusion, hatred, division, and getting people to feel like they're being victimized with the symptoms, so they love him. They love Big Brother in the book 1994, as the ever-Trumpers love Donald Trump. They don't care that he's an adulterer. They don't care that he lies. They don't care that he cheats. They don't care that he's charged the government huge amounts of money for his own benefit and so on. He is their guy, and that dark force is a force in the universe, and it's a force on the planet. And one way to meet that, the most powerful way, is what you suggested here in your phrase, Steve, which is moving from Big Brother to Big Brotherhood. And we've even seen that recently by Don O'Neill, who wrote for the New York Times, that we all have to pull together in this coronavirus. Everybody has to do their part. And the only way forward is these harsh measures that we're seeing successfully put into play in China and Italy and South Korea and elsewhere. And if we back off and now let the market rule, and here the markets bounce back when Trump has given this absurd happy talk, sacrificing thousands of doctors and care people and lives to his reelection by having the market go back artificially. It won't last, but it bumped up because the rule of the 1% money is the core problem of democracy. We have to alter that. And the way to do it is just to appeal to people's heart, to their compassion, to their common sense. And what Lorna Byrne says is that she's been shown that the only place this can happen is in America. And she has been around the world and seen these American angels, so-called, as she says, recruiting people to come to America. We look at all the immigrants. We look at the, you know, the immigrants that are in the progressive movement in America, including that great chef Jose Alves, which is now talking about creating a feeding for everybody in America, modeled on what he said was the WPA and FDR's time. So we need to bring back that vision. So, Steve, I'm going to hand it over to you here. Let's talk about how we can bring that love vision back. I will once again remind people, you can listen to Lorna Byrne yourself and feel the energy of however you feel it. It's not religious. It's not an institutional. She was actually banned from the Catholic Church in many cases of parishes because she had this direct communication that didn't have to go through the male institution. So it's Lorna Byrne, KGNU.org. What you go to is KGNU.org/livingdialogues. And my other programs on, 1994, the impeachment crisis and where we are at kgnu.org/connections, and just scroll down. So go for it, Steve.
Well, this is really very interesting because my little ebook with Joseph McCormick, who's the transpartisan, conservative transpartisan pioneer that we wrote about 8 or 10 years ago, we talk about the evolution of revolution. And, you know, in the past, revolution has been led by one strong leader, or in the last century, the 20th century, we've had people like Nelson Mandela and Gandhi and Martin Luther King, who had moral authority but still were individuals. And now the evolution of revolution is recognizing that it's the aggregate, we the people, the
yes.
actual the designated sovereigns of this country by the Declaration of Independence. We have a designated sovereign that our rights don't derive from a king that are beamed down on us or bestowed from on high, but we have the right to life, liberty, and happiness, just like grass has the right to grow. It's from the grassroots up. And so perhaps
right on.
in this crisis, essentially everything that can be done can only be done locally, because basically it's the people on the ground.
Can I say one thing, Steve, here,
yeah.
real quickly about evolution? I'm a student of this for decades. Evolution, we now know, does not proceed one step at a time. It proceeds by punctuated equilibrium, step by step, and then there's a leap. We've been crushed downward into a crouch. We can't take one step forward to take one step backward to take two steps forward. It has to happen locally, and it has to be a leap. And it's the diamond consciousness I was shown of collaboration and deep listening and dialogue that you are propagating, that I'm propagating, and that our deep listeners are being evoking. That's the key.
Thank you so much, Duncan Campbell. Go to my WikiPolitiki website and find out more about Duncan Campbell, and listen to some of those dialogues. We'll be back with you again next week on WikiPolitiki. This is Steve Behrman.
Muchas gracias.